Chapter 5 The dog-collar brigade was due to arrive mid-afternoon. Anyone else would have arrived in time for lunch, Mr. Bagthorpe said, but Aunt Penelope would not allow Uncle Claude to drive at more than 40 miles per hour, even on motorways. Also, they intended to picnic on the way, and would naturally have to make a detour to do this, because Aunt Penelope would not want her family taking in exhaust fumes with their hermetically sealed sandwiches. A quick snack in one of the motorway stations was out of the question. "I did suggest it," Mrs. Bagthorpe said, "but you could almost see her going pale at the thought, even over the telephone. She really does have rather a complex about germs." "Was her maiden name, by any chance?" inquired her husband. "Lister?" The young Bagthorpes would normally have contrived to be well out of the way when the DB arrived, and to stay there as long as possible. On this occasion, however, they wanted to be present, partly because they were by now in a state of high excitement and anticipation over their maggots and molds, and partly to reassure themselves that the sainted aunt had not undergone a personality change. "It would be just our luck," William said, "if she'd been to a psychiatrist and got cured. Father did suggest it, you know, last time she came." "Even if she had, she'd be just as awful," Jack said. "There's all the texts and parables and things, remember." "Maggots and mold will not cure her of that," William pointed out. "Our whole strategy would be useless." "I wonder how you do cure people of texts," Rosie said thoughtfully. "Do you know what she said to me last time when I showed her my self-portrait? She said, 'Vanity, vanity, all is vanity.' And I think that was a really horrible thing to say, because I hadn't tried to make myself look pretty at all. Mother said it didn't even do me justice." After lunch, which was a sketchy affair because Mrs. Fosdick wanted to save herself for the evening meal, Grandma announced that she was going up to change. "I have a strong sense of occasion," she claimed, looking pointedly at Mr. Bagthorpe's open-necked shirt and baggy jeans. "You tell me when there's an occasion," he replied, "and I'll dress for it." "Perhaps you should tidy yourselves up a little, darlings," Mrs. Bagthorpe told her offspring hesitantly. "Just as a gesture." "All right," agreed William surprisingly, and flashed a warning look at the others, who all had their mouths open, ready to protest. "It's strategy," he told his indignant siblings on their way upstairs. "We must look as if we're being cooperative, to avert suspicion." Had he known it, Mrs. Bagthorpe was already vaguely disturbed by so ready an agreement to her suggestion. For her children to leap to tidy themselves was much out of character. "Though perhaps they are genuinely pleased that they are to see their cousins," she told herself, because she tried to think positively whenever possible. When the DB car rolled sedately up the drive at just after 4, the younger Bagthorpes ranged themselves tidily and politely behind their mother on the steps to greet them. Uncle Claude and his offspring were the first to get out. Aunt Penelope remained in her seat with her eyes closed. She always, she had told Mrs. Bagthorpe, offered up a prayer of thanks for her family's safety after a journey, however short. "For one may be killed on a short journey as easily as on a long one," she said. She sometimes missed connections on account of this practice. She sat in waiting rooms with her eyes shut while her train drew out. It was easy enough to greet Uncle Claude pleasantly, because he was so inoffensive and had a nice smile. He seemed a genuinely happy man, which struck the Bagthorpes as astonishing, considering what he had to live with. "How lovely to see you, Claude," enthused Mrs. Bagthorpe, embracing him. "And Mother is so thrilled that you could come. And how are you?" she inquired of her nephew and niece, who were standing formally, waiting to be noticed. "Quite well, thank you, Aunt Laura," they replied in unison. "It's very nice of you to have us," added Esther. "We like coming here because of the cooking," said Luke, with patent truthfulness. He was a stout child, who evidently had regular access to food not supplied by his mother, this food being of a sweet and unwholesome variety, judging by the spottiness of his complexion. His eyes behind his spectacles were small and unwinking, and missed nothing. Rosie, being nearest in age to Esther, stepped forward, prompted by a nudge from Tess. "Hello," she said. "I'm building a house in a tree, and you'll be able to help." This was doubtful in the extreme. In the first place, Esther was unlikely to jeopardize the outstanding neatness of her person by monkeying about in a tree, and in the second, her mother would almost certainly forbid it. There were definitely insects in trees, and the tree in question would be particularly suspect. "You try convincing her humans can't catch Dutch elm disease," William had said. Aunt Penelope herself now advanced, blinking a little. She was tall and white, with limp, useless-looking hands, and she moved gropingly, like someone playing blind man's buff. Mrs. Bagthorpe greeted her warmly, but did not embrace her or even take her hand. Nobody ever embraced Aunt Penelope, nor did she offer her hand. Nobody had seen her embrace her own children, even, and Mr. Bagthorpe had once observed that the fact that Aunt Penelope had children at all was enough to make one seriously consider the proposition that they were found under gooseberry bushes. She stood at a safe distance from the Bagthorpes, and bestowed her blessings on them while they stared back at her unmoved. All of them forgot that they had meant to smile and look welcoming. She observed that they had grown, and they did not contradict her. Grandma then appeared. She was got up in a way that would have been very flattering to most visitors, but even as she was embracing Claude, you could see that Aunt Penelope was mentally saying, "Consider the lilies of the field." Grandma looked not even remotely like a lily of the field, being elaborately coiffured, bedecked with rings and brooches, and sporting a fair acreage of lace. She had probably gone to all this trouble to annoy Aunt Penelope, and to show Mr. Bagthorpe that she considered her elder son worth such trouble.
Are these yours?
"Now let's go and have a nice cup of tea," cried Mrs. Bagthorpe, with an extremely hospitable air. "Oh, but we must wash our hands first," responded Aunt Penelope. "Children, go upstairs and wash your hands thoroughly." Aunt Penelope was herself conducted to the downstairs lavatory, and seconds after she had bolted herself in, there was a scream. The younger Bagthorpes had been anticipating this, because they had accurately foreseen what her first move in the house would be, and had accordingly placed a spider in a strategic position on the hand-basin. Everyone else, however, was taken quite unawares and stared apprehensively at the closed door. It was almost immediately thrown open. "Oh!" shrieked Aunt Penelope. "Oh, oh! Spiders!" "Only one," objected Rosie, and promptly had her foot trodden on by Jack. He had been worried that the spider might get away before Aunt Penelope saw it, and had put two more in there, for luck. "There must be a nest!" Aunt Penelope stood shuddering while Mrs. Bagthorpe, exclaiming, "Surely not," went to investigate. "How very extraordinary," she said, reappearing. "They must have climbed up the waste-pipe. Do go and move them, Jack." Jack willingly went and recaptured them, though they were very lively. He put them in the box he kept at all times in his pocket, ready for the accommodation of insects. It seemed a pity to waste three good spiders that could easily be used again, though he was cunning enough to do a good deal of running of water, to convey the impression that the spiders were being drowned. The party eventually assembled in the kitchen for tea and cakes, because the dinner table had already been laid out in the sitting room. "I do apologize for this," Mrs. Bagthorpe said, "but we simply have not had time to redecorate the dining room." Mrs. Fosdyke was enchanted to be entertaining on her own home ground, and greeted everyone warmly. She was a notoriously bad judge of character, and thought the Reverends were lovely people. She in particular preferred the D.B. offspring to the young Bagthorpes, and did much clucking over them and pressing of cream cakes. Normally they would not have been allowed more than one each, but after her second cup of tea Aunt Penelope rose and said that she wished to go up to her room and rest. As she left, the young D.B. exchanged looks because they had designs on the cakes, and the young Bagthorpes exchanged looks because they were confident that Aunt Penelope was in for anything but a rest. They waited expectantly, but heard nothing. As William later pointed out, no one could expect a 100% success rate in a war waged with live insects, which had a tendency to wander. Tess had suggested that the insects distributed should perhaps be dead ones, but was overruled. "If they're not creeping and crawling," said Rosie with relish, "they won't scare the pants off her the same, and think one might even creep and crawl on her while she's not looking." It was generally agreed that this latter contingency would be the ultimate triumph, and the insects were reprieved.